This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, a good friend, Morgan Reynolds. He was chief economist for the United States Department of Labor during 2001-2002, Bush's first term, and in 2005 he gained public attention as the first prominent government official to publicly claim 9/11 was an inside job. Morgan, you're always going to be remembered for that, my friend.
Yeah, I jumped the normal channels that I swam in and caught some attention, and I think to the better for the Republic.
Have you received law static from that, from former associates in the government?
Now I think back, there was a little, what's going on, Morgan? They thought I was a sensible man. So I did get a little of that, but I didn't get any serious static. These were more from peers rather than superiors. And, you know, what astounded me was how I got attacked almost immediately by Jim Hoffman and other what we call 9/11 truthers or truthers.
Yes.
Because I wasn't considered conventional on the plane issue. And of course they were right. Their suspicions proved right that I wasn't conventional on the plane issue. So what surprised me, what I was naive about, was the 9/11 truth movement and the various factions and the struggle for dominance, and a lot of it is suppression, in my opinion, of promising research ideas. And as you know from long experience with the JFK assassination, and now I'm learning, it pretty much stays the same for 47 years.
Well, it seems ridiculous, doesn't it, Morgan? But there are factions that seem more concerned with concealing the truth than revealing it. And I'm sorry to say that while Jim Hoffman earned some credibility early on with an analysis of the energy requirements to destroy the Twin Towers, demonstrating that they far exceeded anything that could be provided by gravity, or, you know, combined with these plane crashes and fires, which actually, of course, turned out to be very modest, he nevertheless began attacking scholars within the months after I founded it in December of 2005. It really took me aback, Morgan, and if anyone wants to know more about, you know, my interactions with Jim Hoffman, they can go to 911scholars.org, click on articles, go to general articles, and scroll down to the bottom of the page, and they'll find two articles I wrote in response to attacks by Jim Hoffman and another fellow called Michael Green, but principally Jim Hoffman. And would you believe today, Morgan, although 9/11 blogger in the past, you know, around 2006, for example, was a pretty good outlet for 9/11 discussion, his girlfriend or wife, Victoria Ashley, is now running the shop there at Blogger, and she's been a terrible person at attacking those who were out there on the cutting edge, I'd put it that way.
Well, when I think back, I've got a similar experience, although you can always say that these kind of provocations lead to some better science. In my case, I was able to answer Hoffman pretty promptly on our minor differences on what I was willing then to still call a controlled demolition, that it was somehow a conventional explosive. I really hadn't studied that carefully enough, but we knew it wasn't a collapse caused by planes and jet fuel fires. But then I had to get go deeper on the planes issue, and that I spent some 8 months on that article, which then came out in early 2006, called "We Have Some Holes in the Plane Story." And there, in other words, I took a really serious look. I had to be really right. I wasn't just conjecturing that there were some puzzling features here. You know, like I noted in my first article, I said, these holes don't look big enough if you're going to tell me they swallowed aluminum planes. that kind of thing.
I like that.
I was raising questions, but then, you know, Rick Ryder helped me, the MIT engineering grad student, and Gerard Holmgren and Rosalie and Nico. I was getting their input to at least I got some response from them by the time I had it well crafted. So what it did, Hoffman provoked me for the better, and that's the way a lot of science and research endeavors go. You've got a rival who's coming down hard on you. Well, let's have another look and see if we can answer these questions, and it stimulates the unearthing of new knowledge, we hope.
And, of course, your article with Rick Ryder was published in the 9/11 conspiracy, my first book on 9/11, where I'm now, you know, working on a second, and anticipate having another very fine article from you in that one, Morgan, too, which I, of course, already have in hand.
Right, and I'll probably get a chance to update that before.
Yes, you will. You will indeed.
Okay.
I got to say, you know, I owe you this huge debt because back in the beginning, you know, you were beating up on me for not really looking closely at the videos of the Twin Tower hits. And I had myself a kind of a psychological block, which I think is still common to many members of the truth community, of distinguishing between the planes and the fakery, because I was familiar with video fakery in relation to JFK, where the Zapruder film turns out to be a kind of a mini masterpiece of reconstructing original footage to take out important events such as the limo stop during which JFK was hit twice, fell forward, Jack eased him up and was looking him right in the face when he was hit a second time in the right temple, blew his brains out to the left rear. They had to take out that limo stop because it was such a blatant indication of Secret Service complicity. And in the course of doing that, they contracted the timeline, and it meant that they didn't have enough time left for Clint Hill, for example, to do all the things he did when he rushed forward to protect Jackie. He got up on the limo on the back, he pushed her down, he got over her, he was peering down into the seat and looking at this gaping fist-sized hole in JFK's back, and turning to the others with a thumbs down, meaning they had a mm-hmm. mortally wounded president. And none of that is actually, he did all that before they got to the triple underpass, Morgan, and now there's a new book called The Kennedy Detail out there where Clint Hill is actually going around with Jerry Blaine, who is the author of the book, but with contributions from others, and he's talking about his experience. And what John Costello, who's done so much work on the film, noticed right away when I sent him a link to one of these book signings was that Clint Hill was saying the same thing he said for 47 years about what he did, and it's not in the film. So that, you know, what we have here is another proof of fakery that comes from an unexpected source, Clint Hill himself, so that I've published a piece now entitled Who's Telling the Truth, Clint Hill or the Zapruder Film, which anyone can find by doing a simple Google. But the realization that you could have video fakery with or without the planes was what enabled me finally wrap my mind around it. And, of course, it was thanks to you, really, Morgan, more so than anyone else, that I began to focus on that issue.
Yeah, our shortcoming in that whole area is, while I think we've proven beyond a reasonable doubt these airliners did not crash at any of these four sites, what did happen? And that's what I'm working on, as I mentioned to you a few days ago. I don't want to talk about it because I'm in the same position here where I've got to be able to prove it back and forth.
Right.
Beyond reasonable doubt. Of course, I'll be widely attacked. But there is a theory, I think, that is viable, and I'm working my way through it. It's one of these cases that people like you and me get approached by John Good Citizen or Jane Good Citizen and say, what about this? Here's where you need to go.
Yeah.
And I've got, in this instance, I think a very promising lead that's holding up well against all the tests I can subject it to, but I'm not willing to go public yet.
Well,
but that's what we really need, of course.
Yeah.
Is, all right, if airliners didn't crash in there, what did? So, for example, there's a debate. The Pentagon is the best case where we're closest to a consensus on the no plane or no airliner. And, okay, well, was it a cruise missile or some kind of missile, or was it planted explosions? Those
yeah.
are the two things we, the two theories or hypotheses we need to discern which ones really accounts for the evidence. So, hey, I want to go back to this issue again of resistance from
yeah.
various sources. I read antiwar.com on most mornings, and Justin Raimondo, who is the leading spokesperson or founder of it, begins today, and this really is very annoying because antiwar.com, as so many anti-war, left, right, center, people won't go there on 9/11, and he's a good example. And he starts off, he says, on September 11, 2001, when those planes rammed into the World Trade Center, the impact was so forceful that it not only demolished the buildings, it ripped a hole in the space-time continuum.
Yeah,
how many things were going to get wrong? Well,
that's so stupid, I can't believe it. Is he just indulging in literary hyperbole?
Yes, he's a stylist.
Yeah.
But he goes on. The result was that we entered another dimension, one familiar to comic book aficionados, Bizarro World, where the laws of logic and reason are inverted. Up is down, right is wrong. And, well, what is he exercised about? He's exercised by another libertarian-oriented website, Reason, carries this article by a blogger named Stephen J. Smith, who is identified as an intern serving with the Institute for Humane Studies. It's kind of another one of these think tank foundation type operations that I'm kind of that my crowd. And it was said, here was what Stephen J. Smith wrote, quote, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev has been quick to blame the attack, referring to the 35 victims of the terrorists in Moscow. Has been quick to blame the attack on terrorists, probably from the rest of North Caucasus. And President Obama has issued a similar statement. But Western press reports leave out one important bit of context. There is widespread and mainstream speculation that many of the terrorist attacks attributed to Chechens in recent years were actually perpetrated by the Russian secret services. The further the political aims of an ever more authoritarian Russian state, the 1999 apartment bombings triggering the Second Chechen War are widely suspected to have been the work of the FSB, the KGB's successor organization. Well, you know, then Raimondo just goes about how this is just outrageous and unsupported and so on and so forth. So here's a case where, hey, wait a minute, who's our first suspect in any one of these major terrorist events? It's the state itself, the national security state. You know, in other words, they caused the problem, and then they step forward with the solution, which involves more power and money
for
them and their allies. So, you know, like, how can Justin Raimondo be this naive is what I ask. And I have given like $50 a quarter in the past, and then I'd get mad at them for covering up or not being at all cognizant of what 9/11 was about. And then I say, I'm not going to give. Here's another case where I say, I'm never going to give to these guys
again.
Well,
it's stupid, Morgan. I mean, does this guy know nothing about history? I mean, Israel, you know, the Zionist crowd specialized in false flag attacks. They dressed up as Arabs when they bombed the King David Hotel, for example. There are the incidents down in Buenos Aires in 92 and 94. They attempted to bomb the Mexican
Congress. Well, isn't the motto the Mossad? By deception, wage war.
Exactly. And then we have all the terrorist attacks, you know, false flag attacks by the United States itself.
Really annoying is that you can just look at public information and incentives. Like, I have one article on my website, nomoregames.net, where I just look at the defense budget. You know, in the 90s, we ended the 90s with a lower spending level. Forget about inflation. And they had no enemy. The military-industrial complex was withering on the vine. And, of course, this wasn't just the, the New Century guys, you know, PNAC, Project for the New American Century, calling for a new Pearl Harbor. So I just established, look at these guys are going away. And, what uniform guy? They're looking for an enemy. Well, bingo, we produce one, you know. The Muslim world, terrorism.
Terrorism is
so lame and frustrating that people can't see through this fraud.
And it's so perfect politically, Morgan, because you can arrange a terrorist attack anytime you need it politically. There are no geographical boundaries. If you claim it's a terrorist attack, who's going to be around to explain that you're wrong? I mean, you know, you and I and others may be sorting these things out.
Paul Craig Roberts. I thought the New York Times or CBS were going to do it.
There was a time, Morgan, I think there may have been a time, you know, when you could count on some of those great institutions to have investigated, but it's been long past, you know. I mean, William Colby told us that the CIA owns everyone of consequence in the major media, and before him, of course, Carl Bernstein, as long ago as 1977, discovered CIA officials were boasting about their successes in infiltrating the New York Times, Time Life, and CBS. So,
the mighty Wurlitzer.
The mighty Wurlitzer.
Wisner.
That's exactly right. And, you know, so we I mean, how can this guy, Raimondo, be so naive? I mean, even Hitler staged phony attacks. The Reichstag fire is one, and this alleged invasion by Polish troops was another. I mean, it's ridiculous. I mean, is he
complete? Well, and the guy, you know, he is a smart guy, and I agree with about 90% of what he writes. Just to show you how smart he is, I did another article on my website, which is The Assassination of JFK, 9/11, and David Rockefeller. Well, in there, I go the route of Russ Baker and his wonderful book on the Bush crime family.
Family of Secrets.
Family of Secrets. And I quote Justin Raimondo, who's really driving off Murray Rothbard. And Murray Rothbard was always into, well, which individuals acted to create the Federal Reserve. Who did what? When he does his monetary history of the United States, he names names and who's cooperating with who and where they, what positions they held previously and subsequently. So he's looking at this revolving door of decision makers. So Raimondo makes a very nice statement about there's no central planning committee issuing orders for this vast web of the elite. It's not a matter of doing weird parties off in the Bohemian Grove and the like. You know, it doesn't all have to be about pedophilia. All it is what's really key is congruent interests. For example, you look at the Eastern banking establishment and energy. Come on, you know, the Rockefeller, what was Rockefeller, John D. Rockefeller originally? He is oil. He is energy. And, you know, the Sullivan and Cromwell, what's that? That's the Rockefeller law firm. That's energy.
Yes.
What about big oil and Eastern banking? And you look at, you know, George Herbert Walker Bush. What? Come on, he's planted out there in West Texas. Don't tell me, if you go to the Bush Museum and Library, which, by the way, I used to look at from my office window when they established the School of Public Service, the Bush School. I would look out at it. Well, you go in there, and it's all about, they'll have the Studebaker and the coaster wagon, you know. Oh, the pioneering Bush family going on.
Yes.
You know, the spinning the myth. It's all, you know, Philip Zelikow type fantasy, you know. Well, they string it all. There are facts there, but come on, this is pretty naive and superficial.
You know, something that bothers me tremendously, Morgan, is that after having to endure two terms with W at the helm and getting us into all these terrible wars and tax cuts for the rich and squandering our resources, now we have Obama, who seems to be nothing more than Bush Light. I mean, he kept the same Secretary of Defense, kept the same director of the FBI. He seems to have bought into the mythology of 9/11. So he sends 30,000 more troops to Afghanistan because we're hunting for Osama bin Laden, who without any doubt died around 15 December 2001. I mean, what's with this guy, Morgan? Is it, is
well, as we've discussed before, you actually had hopes for Obama, which I never held. He was CFR approved, and you're going to not get a whole lot there. You know, what the Democrats can point to traditionally, at least, is some zeal to protect civil liberties. Well, of course, there it's a complete, it's worse than ever with Obama. So you can't even point to that. And you know, with the Republicans, they're war crazy. Well, what has he done there? He sustained these bad, unjustifiable attacks that are ongoing and occupations. You know,
he hasn't
done anything there.
I deserve the hits, Morgan. Boy, I was wrong about Obama. Believe me, I admit it.
And then, the Republicans always leave you hopeful as the party of business that they're going to be pro-capitalist, pro-growth, etc. You know, low taxes, but then they forget about tight fiscal policies as well. So it's just, for, you know, both major parties, I've got nothing good to say, with the exception of Ron Paul. Now, we'll see what his son, Rand Paul, he came out, I saw the headline, I didn't see the details, that he has a proposed $500 billion in cuts in spending.
Yes.
But, you know, the whole the reason to be pro-gold and precious metals and agriculture and commodities generally is that the whole gestalt of the dominant economic policy opinion is Keynesian and monetarist, and that we can spend ourselves rich. And the very thing that got us into the boom, and that's inevitably followed by a bust, is reckless credit expansion. And here they're all, you might have seen this headline the other day, out of the World Economic Forum in Davos, Switzerland, where some of the elite get together, and they said, well, in the next decade, we need to double the global volume of credit, which means another $100 trillion of scraps of paper and digits. So here they are, you know, we need more of this artificial stimulus, which, hey, in the short run, it can work, but it's not going to stimulate long-run real economic growth of output, of goods, real goods and services.
Yeah.
So the whole mind, and my profession, of course, the economics trade, is very much responsible, at least in part, because our macro, that's the, when you go to Milton Friedman or Martin Feldstein or whoever you want to name as a prominent macroeconomist, going back to Irving Fisher, it's all variations on a theme. In other words, John Maynard Keynes, what I call malign influence, is still at work. So the, some people contact me and they say, hey, you know, the Chinese are going to start banks here. They're going to take over certain corporations in America, or they're buying up farmland. And I said, well, let's go to the fundamentals of this situation here. China saves a lot. Saving is very much in vogue, okay? And people who save a lot, guess what? They have a lot to invest, both domestically and overseas. Whereas, what do we have in America? And people are just routinely outspend, you know, their income. And the whole mentality is, let's spend ourselves rich, let's consume ourselves rich, whether it's, the government's got to replace any deficit and alleged deficit in private spending, on and on. That's the whole mentality. Well, how much do you have really to invest here, overseas or domestically? And, of course, that is a key driver for real economic growth. That plus good entrepreneurship, invention, and creation of businesses and so on. So this whole thing is, guys, and a lot of your savings are going into, guess what? Deficit government, massive. You know, just staggering. Our federal government, 40% of the money they spend is borrowed. And, of course, a lot of that then is printed. You know, it's not really borrowed from real savers, at least in the short run. So the whole thing is such a unbelievable mess because the wrong principles are believed.
Morgan, we're going to come back. We're going to come back and pick up on some of these themes. We're going to take our first break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my very special guest today, Morgan Reynolds. We'll be right back.
That Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with.
Admits that Saddam Hussein had nothing to do with 9/11. Our own FBI acknowledged it has no hard evidence that ties Osama bin Laden to 9/11. But if Saddam had nothing to do with 9/11, and if Osama had nothing to do with 9/11, then who did it? Who did it? The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer. Discover the big picture. Learn what we know now. Find out what it means. 11 experts contribute to exposing the truth as the anatomy of an atrocity. Edited by James H. Fetzer. Buy it now if you have the courage to face the truth. Just don't think you're going to like it. The 9/11 conspiracy provides the answer.
Yeah.
is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal. Continuing with my special guest today, Morgan Reynolds, who's a professor emeritus at Texas A&M, former director of the Criminal Justice Center at the National Center for Policy Analysis, which is based in Dallas, and who is the first prominent public official, government official, to publicly claim 9/11 was an inside job. Morgan, we just had a State of the Union address from Barack Obama. It was pretty mild stuff, by and large, but I want to give you two brief reactions to it that are featured on my Facebook page and just ask for your reaction. One is directly to the State of the Union by Joel Hirshhorn, who is the co-chair of Scholars. By telling the lie that the State of the Union is strong, Obama removed the necessary motivation for Americans to get their distracted and delusional minds oriented in the right direction. The nation needs to shift into crisis mode. What if he turned around, looked straight at the Speaker of the House and said, "This man has all the wrong ideas and is the enemy of the vast majority of Americans"? Would the Speaker have cried? Here's another more general on the State of the Union from Paul Craig Roberts, one of our most noted public intellectuals. Anyone who doesn't believe that the U.S. is an incipient fascist state needs only to consult the latest assault on civil liberty by Fox News. Instead of informing citizens, Fox News informs on its citizens. Jason Ditz reports that Fox News, no longer content to simply shill for a growing police state, turned in a grandmother to the Department of Homeland Security for making anti-American comments.
Yeah.
Morgan, how low have we sunk? I mean,
it's amazing that we can keep on sinking lower, isn't it? But hey, it reminds me of the story about Jesse Ventura and his True TV conspiracy theory series, where he supposedly produced a show on the FEMA camps.
Right.
And guess what? Somebody pressured True TV to not display or show the show.
No, it was actually...
Well,
it was,
talk about confirmation.
It was broadcast. The claim is it's no longer... They're not going to be allowed to rebroadcast.
No, okay.
And then it's been made unavailable. No, I watched it. It was a simply excellent program. He actually went to some of these camps. They found these massive stacks of enormous coffins, Morgan, that could hold four bodies per coffin. And these, you know, these camps where the barbed wire, of course, was pointed inward rather than outward, so it was to keep people in rather than out. It was really kind of unnerving to watch. And Jesse did a great job. I mean, he's had a half a dozen really quite brilliant programs. The one he did last year about beneath the Denver airport, I don't know if you caught that one, where there's this huge underground facility for the government to operate beneath the Denver airport. It's just enormous. And then, of course, he did this wonderful one on JFK recently, and he did a brilliant piece on the Pentagon, Morgan. I mean, that's something we want to talk about some more. But I worry.
He is wonderful. He's fearless, and he's so believable. He's so passionate, and he is a great asset for the truth and the republic.
He's a great American.
I wanted to go back to John Bonner. Joel there took a swipe at John Bonner.
Yes.
That reminds me, I spent 1 year on Capitol Hill with the Joint Economic Committee on leave from Texas A&M in 1993-94.
Yeah.
And you hear lots of scuttlebutt, and you're in the midst of all this. And John Bonner, I can remember one of the House members and my chief of staff, they didn't like him at all because he was a rhino, Republican in name only.
Yes.
Kind of a oily guy, you know. Okay, he's handsome, but who's going to follow him in the battle, you know?
Yes. Yes.
He doesn't really stand for anything, so why is he there? But, you know, most of them are, it's all about being there. And the longer you're there, it's more and more about that than any ideology that drove you originally. Now, of course, this isn't true to a member of the House, but the House I really liked because it's all a street fight. And back then, I thought I thought the R's and the D's, you know, the battle, it really did matter.
Yes.
For example, when I got there, I was working for the minority staff, you know, with the Joint Economic Committee. So you get the secretary, nobody, the majority doesn't want, you know, you get the old computers. And then when you become the majority, well, then you're in charge. You know, and there's so many stories about how Congress runs. I'll tell you one more, and that is you can't schedule a hearing officially when you're a minority member or the minority party. Only the majority, they run everything. So you find out maybe a week in advance that they're going to have a hearing, let's say, on the national laboratories that the federal government runs, these chain of national labs. Okay. So you have to run around and, you know, we want to have some minority witnesses. You only have a few days to recruit other people to come in and try to offset the stuff that the majority is going to throw out there. It's quite a circus. It was in a way, it was a lot more fun than being at a high level in the executive.
Morgan, let me ask you this. I mean, I listened to Obama last night. It was all kind of, you know, just pablum, really. It wasn't very significant. It's not a memorable speech. I don't think there was a line in it that anyone's going to repeat. But what struck me about it was he said so little about two major issues. One is the wars, of course. There was practically nothing about the wars. I mean, there was some pap about winding down the American role, but I don't think anyone believed anything he was saying about the war. And the other had to do with the Fed. I mean, as I understand it, the Fed can just, at its own whim, print off trillions of dollars, and no one controls it, no one audits it, no one is responsible. This seems to me stunning, and since you must know so much more about the Fed than I would like for your thoughts about it.
Well, it is slightly exaggerated, but the truth in your statement is there, and that is that's independence, it's called, if you want to take another more favorable spin, right? And economists have been way long on this, in my opinion, and that is, well, we can't, you know, have monetary policy run by Congress. I agree with that, too. But why does it have to be, the Fed, you look at who is their constituency. It's the big banks. It's not the little banks, by the way, you know, the community banks or the, you know, recent startup banks. And this has been brought out publicly and led to various forms of public outrage, including the form that the Tea Party is. So you go back to 1913, it was drawn up by bankers for bankers and a couple of economists by, you know, a little cabal. They had their secret car, their compartment car, down to Jekyll Island off the Georgia coast. Remember, transportation was very limited compared to what we can do today. So that was a resort, a winter resort, privately owned. So it was the Morgan and Rockefeller factions coming together, and they drew up a bill. This was supposed to be the answer to the panics. They didn't call them recessions or depressions back then. It was panic. It was like an electrical outage, you know. The booms would, overexpansion of credit would lead to malinvestment, is the language I hear, and the Austrian economists use. And then there's a bust. But since nobody believed back then that these recessions or panics were basically free market resolved. After World War One, we had the last so-called free market recession, 1921, where Hoover wanted to intervene. He was Secretary of Herbert Hoover was Secretary of Commerce back then. But you know, the thing ended before they could start up any interventions. So that, you know, the market washed out the bankrupt investments and growth. Assets went to new hands, kind of the liquidation, they call it. You know, well, that got a bad name when you talk about mass murder.
wasn't it a blunder that the founding fathers warned us against to even create a central bank, just as it's a blunder for us to become involved in foreign entanglements?
Alexander Hamilton was the first Treasury Secretary, and he was very much like Abraham Lincoln and other prominent politicians in our past have been all about, that's the way the Republican Party started too, and they were all about infrastructure, kind of aping the European powers, and they have central banks. So we had our episodes. Andrew Jackson and the so-called populist. Jackson was very sophisticated about money. He knew what he was doing, ending the second bank of the United States. So there's always been this streak of, we're kind of a stepchild or a spinoff, I shouldn't say stepchild, of Britain and Europe generally in our culture and a lot of people want to emulate the Europe. So that's what, and remember, the Federal Reserve had this decentralized nature, 12 districts and all that. And they, Wilson signed it on just before the Christmas break in December 1913. So the media because there's a lot of opposition to having a European central bank that operates on behalf of the big bankers. There's sophisticated people against it too, but the general public was all against this. And gold and silver were still the dominant coinage, and silver certificates, gold certificates. Anyway, we had an honest money back in those days, or close as you can get to it in a real world. And so the Federal Reserve is the bank of last resort to create an elastic supply of money and credit. Now, in other words, inflation is announced on behalf of who? Well, it's not for the little guy, but it has this, this cover that's really been torn now, and now we see what it really is behind that mask. And economists have been very naive about this, thinking it's established for the public welfare, including Milton Friedman, by the way. In other words, Chicago, the kind of the leader, the most famous economist, perhaps, of the 20th century. It's between he and John Maynard Keynes. But so the Federal Reserve basically can't, because Federal Reserve, you look in your wallet, the currency is a Federal Reserve note, right? It's not a U.S. Treasury issued, or it's not a warehouse certificate for a gold bar or silver.
Right, it's not redeemable. It's not redeemable for anything.
No, it's what they call fiat paper money. And as long as people have confidence somehow in the government and the system, they will surrender or exchange real goods and services for this paper, which is, it's garbage.
Intrinsically worthless, yes.
Yeah. So the Fed keeps the counterfeiting privilege to itself. They send out the Secret Service.
Well, but if they can just print
crack
off...
Crack down on free enterprise-type counterfeiters. So this rests on a giant set of beliefs. The court intellectuals, including the economists, are all into this form of central planning. That's what it is. Of course, the central planning in the great large is discredited by various failures, including the Soviet Union, the failure of socialism to deliver the goods. But here we have this. The notion that a group of 15 guys and a couple of women can decide what's the right rate of interest or the basic rate of interest is rubbish. There's no justification for it. The government, of course, has always been heavily into the banking system for obvious reasons. The really sudden reason. That's where the money is.
Yeah.
And this is a huge problem, but Ron Paul has a very readable little 200-page book in the Fed, and it's very sound, from this economist's perspective, very well argued and very sound. Now, that's one of the hopes on the horizon, that Ron Paul is the new chairman of the Monetary Subcommittee, and Ron Paul is he's probably more knowledgeable about it than I am, and I'm very knowledgeable. And you can really embarrass Ben Bernanke and company. They're going to be floundering. They need to hire a second and third PR firm. They hired a PR firm, the woman who actually was a PR agent for Enron, of all things. So I'm saying, hey, here's a good precedent. Ron Paul's going to make it very uncomfortable for the Fed. His audit the Fed bill which was diluted and ended up going nowhere, is likely to go somewhere now. And, you know, lots of Democrats and Republicans, he had it overwhelming, but then the Senate watered it down. You know how civilized the Senate is and all that, kind of protecting the establishment.
Well, is it going to help then with Ron Paul in the House and with Rand Paul in the Senate?
Yeah, well, Rand won't, presumably he won't have a whole lot of clout early on, but certainly Ron Paul's got a powerful position. And, you know, given the populist orientation of the House anyway, it's supposed to be the House of the People. This is going to be great fun to watch. And I know one of the economists I like, Doug North, had a very good agenda for Ron Paul. You know, friendly agenda. And so it's going to be very, very hot for Ben Bernanke and company because, you know, they fundamentally, intellectually, they cannot make this case for who and what they are. And, you know, Neil Barofsky, who's the Inspector General for the U.S. Department of the Treasury, you know how much money they put out and guarantees and credit, what the grand total was for this financial crisis? $22.7 trillion. When you add up all the guarantees between the federal government and the Federal Reserve, and tracking this down is just impossible.
It's just unconscionable when you're talking about sums like that. I mean, is the Fed anything more than a glorified printing press? I mean, really, truly, is it?
Yeah. Well, and what's you know, what's really damaging about this artificial creation of money and credit is who gets it first are the big gainers, and that's not the little guy, right?
Right.
The government, the government itself is a gainer by this inflation of money and credit because they get first round spending, but it's also the big banks. You know, and it's the bond traders where they, you know, why does it, somebody pointed out, hey, why does the Federal Reserve have to buy it from these six bond trading companies, you know, including Goldman Sachs?
Yeah, a friend of mine who's a libertarian too, but he's also in the mortgage business, pointed out to me that the whole problem with the housing bubble was aggravated by Bush going along with tightening up credit so that instead of being able to declare bankruptcy and shed yourself of debts, that it was the greed of the banks and financiers was that to make it harder and harder for the average guy to do that, and that this actually was the precipitating factor in causing it all to tumble down. I wonder about your view on that.
Well, unless you're going to go to the limit of Zimbabwe, they have to. All you have to do is flatten out the growth of money and credit, because these guys know they get toward the edge of the precipice. Even Keynes said once price inflation annually gets to 15% or more, there's no turning back. So they actually, in a sense, you have to suffer a recession because of the boom that the Federal Reserve caused. I'm not in favor of recessions, but when you, I'm afraid it's kind of like the bad taste of castor oil, you know, the medicine. So it's one of these things where all you have to do is flatten out this and say, hey, this has gotten out of hand. You know, houses, people are camping out. They're paying $1 million for a shack in Southern California. You know how the boom mentality, oh, this will never end. You know, everybody has to have a place to stand. Land prices never fall. The whole boom mentality just gets totally ridiculous.
And the
bankers just decide, well, you know, we've lent to every Tom, Dick, and Harry who can't repay our loan, so we better pull in our horns. Well, that's all it takes. All of a sudden, and nobody knows, you know, what kind of, the whole thing is set to fall. You know, what's going to be a tripwire, we don't know.
You know, it seems to me, Morgan, that if they took all that money they gave to the banks and the big investment houses, like Goldman Sachs, and just given it to ordinary people, that they would have gone out, they would have spent it, it would have increased demand, which would have precipitated an increase in supply, and we might have been able to regenerate some kind of economic activity. But giving it to these big banks, they went out and they bought other banks. You know, you talked about those little banks, Morgan. A lot of them were bought up using that TARP money by the big banks.
Now, here's the secret. Once a commodity, like, okay, historically it's been gold and silver, the two favorite precious metals, but it's even been copper, it's been cattle earlier, cigarettes in a prisoner of war camp. But anyway, when something is money, and there's enough of it around to perform its basic function, new money doesn't add anything. Okay? It's already serving the monetary function. Now, in a system with a more or less static or very modestly, like 1% growth per year, like you have gold added or silver added by hard rock mining, once you've got this kind of, what happens to the price level, the general level of prices, is that they begin to gently fall as the growth of goods and services proceeds. In other words, you know, this is the benign form of free market capitalism, okay? And you don't need to have, you know, escalator clauses and all that stuff, because people generally benefit from the cheap, you know, it's more productive, it's cheaper to produce things, and the price of everything. This is, and you know, what's funny is they talk about the threat of price deflation. Well, you know, this is an inverted world we're talking about. I want gasoline to generally fall in price. I want all the good things in life to be generally getting cheaper. You know, I want my wages to be high, but, you know, instead of wage gains, your gains, your improved standard of living would come mostly because of the price level gently falling, you know. As output grows, productivity grows by 2%, 3% per year, prices are generally going to fall 2-3% per year. So this is the, you know, what gets lost in these modern sophisticated discussions are these fundamentals. You don't have to have, contrary to the World Economic Forum, the amount of credit in the system double in the next year, 10 years, in order to have economic growth. You don't need any more money. And this is where Ludwig von Mises, the famous Austrian economist, calls, he says, but people are incorrigible. You know, once you kind of wash out the squandered capital investments that were misdirected in the previous boom by the recession, it starts all over again. You know, that's what's really a shame, is that right now, what are all the solutions? Well, it's basically more heroin, inject more keep the party going, keep asset prices high, don't have the markets clear. Well, that's just going to sustain high unemployment, for example, as a side effect of all this. You know, even Ben Bernanke, they keep on pushing closer to going over the cliff, because he admits that this latest new injection of 600 or so billion newly created dollars, you know, to buy government debt, is there to keep stock market prices high, and that'll encourage more consumption spending. So this stupid, you know, bad analysis. That's why I'm pessimistic. Some correction is ongoing, but all we are doing is what people call extend and pretend. Kick the can down the road. And what you're going to get, of course, is a bigger collapse than you could have dealt with, honestly, in 2008. Look at these modern governments have run up such debts that they have to default, not necessarily in whole, but in part, on their promises and their repayments. But now they can do it kind of the honest way, which is, hey, you know, we can't, like Ireland could. Well, we just can't make that. We need to reschedule the debt. You know, basically we'll pay you 50 cents on a dollar. That's kind of an honest default, okay? The other way to do it, which I don't think the Fed will go for, because it wrecks the whole system, is just keep on printing, you know. It's a Zimbabwe solution, it's Hungary after World War II, it's Germany after World War One. And as, you know, Lenin said, you know, the most dastardly way to wreck a system is to just go into hyperinflation. So I don't think they're going to do that. But in fact, I think the dollar is going to remain kind of okay for a while, but we're going to be like Japan. You know, they've had a two-decade-long recession / depression. And that's what we're just going to be slugs. That's all.
Morgan, as I look at it, that's an optimistic assessment. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. We'll be right back.
Edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film, framing the patsy, and the silent historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
Come on, come on, come on, please, please, please.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, continuing my conversation with Morgan Reynolds, who was chief economist for the United States Department of Labor during the George W. Bush administration in his first term, and who was the first prominent government official to publicly announce that 9/11 was an inside job, for which, in my opinion, he will always be remembered. Morgan, when Barack Obama came into office, I expected him to take several actions virtually immediately, especially because of his background with respect to constitutional law. I thought he'd repeal the Patriot Act, rescind the Military Commissions Act, close Guantanamo, get our forces out of Iraq and Afghanistan, bring some semblance of constitutional government back to this country. Instead, he has basically done none of the above. He's made a few gestures here and there toward closing Guantanamo, for example, but he's also authorized the assassination of American citizens, and it seems to be wholly without due process. This is precisely the opposite of what I expected from this man. But what is going on?
Well, I wish I knew all the ins and outs, but as I have said repeatedly, Jim, I never had any confidence in him. And, you know, that's what you hope from the left, is that they are going to be anti-war. You certainly can't turn to Republicans. They're big enthusiasts for war, unfortunately. But there's a lot of anti-war sentiment. And yet, sometimes I wondered. I used to be this form of cynic. Whatever policy you want, vote for the other guy, because he's got to move in that direction, you know, to cover his political flank. So if you want an anti-war policy, vote for the warmonger.
Maybe
that's, you know, this is a little kind of a humorous play on being a cynic, but there you kind of want, he came out as sort of an anti-war candidate, although he talked up, you know, we need to do more in Afghanistan. That should give you some worry right away, but like we were going to withdraw ultimately, or he pretends we are in Iraq today. But another thing is that, you know how much these guys glory in war. Remember, LBJ didn't. I don't think he was so much worried about appeasing the military-industrial complex. Although, yeah, he always leaned that way. But he thought greatness was being a war president. You know, FDR demonstrated that. And FDR, contrary to these hagiographic type histories, viewed himself as a failure, getting us, he never did get us out of the Great Depression, but, you know, put 12 million men under arms, and that's a Great Depression and all that. So, you know, how and heads of state of, you know, this long tradition of being the best warrior is the head of the, so there's all these thousands of ingredients that go into this that leave our hopes dashed.
Let me just interject an historical contrast, which is this. It seems to me that Barack Obama is secure from assassination by and large. I mean, apart from a maybe bona fide low nut, because he's coddling all the powerful interests in this country. He's coddling the military. He's coddling the arms industry. He's coddling the warmongers. He's coddling the bankers. I don't think he faces anything like the risk JFK confronted when he faced down the powerful interests in this country. It's beautifully explained in James Douglas's book, JFK and the Unspeakable, which shows how Jack, as he grew from something closer to a traditional cold warrior to a true statesman for peace, antagonized the CIA, the Joint Chiefs, the Mafia, the bankers, big businessmen. You know, he was abolishing the Fed. He'd instructed the Treasury to print its own United States notes. He was going to cut the oil depletion allowance. I mean, this was a guy who made the huge mistake of thinking he was president of the United States, Morgan, and he was going to act to benefit the American people. I don't see that happening anytime since.
Yeah, well, regardless of your view about JFK's policies, and Obama has some of that Kennedy charisma, there's no sense in which I don't feel in the land that there's any notion that Obama is going to deliver us, to the city on the hill type thing. The only thing I'd say critically about your assessment of serving all the powerful interests is that some of the shrewder powerful interests realize that continuing down this path is even going to imperil them, simply because these governments there's no way to fund this. And you look at all the welfare state promises from Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, just astronomical deficits. And if you're not able to pacify the people, by throwing out cheap bread, where is this going to end? Maybe the whole ongoing shakedown in North Africa is a clue. Once people lose confidence in the government, and now with WikiLeaks and the internet generally providing more information, a lot of these tyrants and even these elite-serving Western governments, they've got to be nervous about what's going to happen, even in the near term.
Well, that's very interesting, Morgan, and in a way encouraging that maybe there is a possible light at the end of a very long tunnel. I had a conversation with Paul Craig Roberts, who was my guest on the show, during which I kept him on for an extra 15 minutes just to address this question to him, namely, by outsourcing all these jobs, and reducing their labor costs and all that, weren't these companies basically shortchanging the American middle class so that the consumers that they counted upon during their entire existence would no longer have as much money, have discretionary income where they could buy the more valuable products they produce, the pricey, the new cars, the televisions, computers and all that? Weren't they basically putting themselves out of business over the long run by adopting such a short-sighted policy? And he told me that he'd been trying to convince the directors of these major corporations that that was the case, but they were not listening. They were not willing to listen.
Well, I'm not sure I have an easy answer to there's so much involved in trade issues and monetary issues, et cetera, but I would say that is essentially a wrong-headed view. What drives the economy is a supply-side phenomenon, if you want to put it that way, and I think for simple purposes that's a good way to put it, versus a demand-driven, so that employment, it's not so much, you can't artificially boost wages without suffering employment, negative employment consequences. That's the law of demand. And the way to go is high productivity, high employment, and the usual investment. You got to make it attractive here. Now, there is an element of truth in this point of view, in that there is something called an international wage arbitrage going on, okay, which means there is a tendency in a global economy, in a market-driven world, for wages for similar labor skills to equalize. So that means, for example, high-cost union labor, it's costing you $40-$50 an hour, can't compete with a Mexican labor, that's costing you all told $10 an hour. And if you're just putting on nuts on wheel bolts, with an air pressure gun, hey, we can do it either place, and I'm going to go to the cheaper. So there is that element going on. But still, the U.S., the U.S. economy, like any high income, high productivity, has to be cutting edge. That's another factor. In other words, you can't just use old, producing tin buckets or brooms and expect that to just lie peacefully without any competitive intrusion, So it's new industry, it's higher skill industry, et cetera. Although Now, I can tell you this also, that you look at the Bureau of Labor Statistics studies, it's remarkable how one-third of our labor force is going to be low-skill indefinitely. In other words, you know, in nursing homes, you need LPNs. There's cashiers. There's a lot of jobs available for people. Now, they don't pay a whole lot, you know. In other words, they're $10 an hour and so, lower. In any rate, I can't give you a slick answer to this.
I'm not asking for one. It just seems to me that the middle class is being eviscerated, and that those who used to have enough money to buy a Lexus or a flat screen TV or a high tech computer don't have it anymore. They're not going to be purchased by the Mexican who's making $10 an hour, or someone in India who may be making even less. I mean,
There is growing inequality in the distribution of the income. But I would say, hey, kind of the short answer to that is that the elites are being served and self-served. In other words, this goes back to, it overlaps with conspiracy theory. And these Federal Reserve-type interventions, they're not going to be able to sell the American people anymore on this. Well, we had to bail out have J.P. Morgan buy out Bear Stearns. Yeah. We let Lehman Brothers on and on. You guys are lying through your teeth, you know, to save you on Main Street, we had to save everybody with trillions first on Wall Street.
Yeah,
that
ridiculous.
Ain't going to cut it anymore.
Morgan, I can't resist asking you about, going back to JFK. We have a brilliant new book by Phil Nelson entitled LBJ, The Mastermind of JFK's Assassination, which I link to Jim Douglas's book in the following way. Douglas shows how JFK antagonized all these powerful forces, and Phil Nelson explains what they did about it, where Lyndon was the principal player, and I'm very interested in your take on this.
Yeah, my overall take is that the Phil Nelson book is a treat to read. And I would I want to talk about this at some length. But what was so eye-opening to me overall was how good the case was for the prosecution of LBJ. And that's the way Nelson spoke of it in the preamble. He says he comes in late, but does an incredible job making a powerful case that LBJ was at the center, both pre-assassination and post-assassination, and, even argues it more strongly, calling him the mastermind. And I think he defends that very powerfully. Now, I want to back up, Jim, a little bit, and first give some remarks about Barr McClellan's book, Blood, Money, and Power.
Sure.
You know, how LBJ killed JFK, because that book came out in 2003. And I can remember getting it at the time, and I said, I was disappointed. I only read about a quarter of it. I said, there's too much missing here. It's unconvincing. It was too local. And yet this event is national and even international. And McClellan's book, however, has great merit in giving the local story, how LBJ maneuvered his way up the ladder. And at the importance of the Ed Clark Law Firm, Barr McClellan was an attorney in the Ed Clark Law Firm, the big power broker, super lawyer. But McClellan had a number of shortcomings or errors that I want to point out about why this was inadequate, but I think it is proved very useful in the longer run by stimulating Phil Nelson to do, as a partial stimulus, it's a predecessor book. And in particular, McClellan, for example, doesn't address the Secret Service stand down. And, you know, dropping the shield is critical to the mechanics or shooters completing their job. And that includes, why did they go to the Trade Mart and do the 120 or 110 degree turn on the Elm, et cetera. And then the whole business about he just is a little bit naive or uninformed, you know, about why would Lee Harvey Oswald enter a movie theater Why did he even says something? Oh, he had a line in there about Lee Harvey Oswald, quote, had gone to New Orleans for work, unquote. In other words, and McClellan, you know, portrays him as a dedicated Marxist who hated America, you know. And then, you know, he has this factional technique, he calls it. In other words, he's allowing this lawyerly-like exposition before the jury, which does have some facts over here and some way over there, but then he strings the story between them that has way too many gaps. So, for example, he insists Lee Harvey Oswald was a shooter, as was Mack Wallace, as was, and then he's got this Bill Yates, an unidentified guy, and so on, you know. I take it back. I'm not sure whether he tagged Lee Harvey Oswald as a shooter, but in any case, he's just got anonymous people. And he also accuses of Lee Harvey Oswald of doing the Edwin Walker shooting as a test, and so on. You know, so in other words, he's way too weak on the execution of the assassination, and tags it as if it were a local a state shooting.
McClellan, of course. Yeah.
McClellan. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. But in a sense, you know, Nelson uses McClellan and a lot of other important sources, like Robert Caro's uncompleted but three-volume existing biography. So Nelson does a great job. But I want to point out a few things that I consider wrong in the Nelson book, and that is the only real sin of commission I would tag Phil's book with is. He kind of half-heartedly accuses Lee Harvey Oswald as being a shooter, and yet you know the evidence better than I. It's very compelling evidence that there's no way this could have been done. And let me see, check my notes here. But the compelling case is there that LBJ, the way he sets it up in the early chapters, and LBJ was determined to be president. We have this on testimony from the get-go. And I love the way he will return from time to time to, I guess it was the maternal grandmother, but grandma said, that boy is going to end up in prison.
Yes, yes.
And Phil Nelson constantly refers to people giving LBJ the benefit of the doubt. You know, people are just so often weak. He'd be the last guy in the world I would give the benefit of the doubt to.
Yes.
Wife's mother, by the way, who's since passed away, she lived to be 92, but she always said, that man is evil. She could tell by the bags under his eyes.
Well, she was right. Right conclusion. Whether the premise was sufficient is another question, but she had the right conclusion.
Yeah. And the reason I got so interested in this is that I've always had an interest in the JFK assassination. Going back to when I was 18, JFK was the first candidate I ever campaigned for in the Wisconsin primary back then. So it goes back far, but it was basically because I listened to the interview between you and Phil Nelson and thought that was wonderful. And in particular, I said, we can learn something as 9/11 researchers. Look at how far it's gone in 47 years on that. And a lot of the factual parameters settle down, and and all of a sudden, Phil Nelson comes along and makes this very compelling case. So it's kind of a model about how to track your way back into the very heart of the conspiracy.
I think you're right.
So we can
learn
something. Yeah. So, and one of the main things I learned from the Mastermind book was who caused the Secret Service stand down? Now, to go back to this article I'd mentioned earlier that I did, I was working on this channel. Well, look at all the Rockefeller people in the Kennedy cabinet. one of whom is Douglas Dillon. He never got any attention, and yet the Treasury Secretary, Douglas Dillon, is CFR all the way back, Dillon Reed, Rockefeller guy, you know, head of the Museum of Modern Art later, and Rockefeller this and that. I said, well, this is something to investigate. And then, you know, because the Treasury Secretary oversees the Secret Service.
Right. It's a branch of the Department of Treasury, right. Yes. Because they also investigate counterfeiting.
Yes. And now they moved it over to Homeland Security. But for whatever. At any rate, you know, and I'm looking down the hierarchy of the Secret Service to see who the bad guys are, who the good guys are. And yet Phil comes in from this other angle. And, hey, look at Cliff Carter and Jack Puterbaugh. Of course, Carter was the bag man and criminal facilitator,
yes,
of LBJ in Washington, D.C., and Puterbaugh was a USDA employee but a Johnson man. And he was an advanced man, you know, supposedly for the Democratic National Committee, and one of the instruments used to make the destination the trademark, the world trademark, instead of the women's club, which leads to this making of the turn for the presidential parade. And Cliff Carter is making these calls, pressuring the Secret Service and the locals to run the motorcade route there and so on. So I just said, wow. This is brilliant. This is if he hadn't started out on this thesis, maybe this would have never been uncovered.
And Lyndon used to hobnob with his Secret Service. He'd come over to the White House and wind up spending a lot of time chatting it up with the Secret Service. And I think, you know, his motive in retrospect was very clear, because he wanted them to be more committed to him than they were to JFK, and of course that was something he managed to arrange with a couple of key players in particular.
Well, supposedly he had a spy among the detail in the White House, the Secret Service White House detail.
Well, of course, he and J. Edgar were such close friends, and Hoover undoubtedly had the White House bugged, had the Oval Office bugged. He knew what they were going to do before they did it.
Hey, by the way, this reminds me of, you know, this whole business. Robert Morrow is supposedly a bad guy for tracking down all these sexual revelations.
Yeah.
Well, you know, the Secret Service, with JFK having all these trysts with women,
you know,
traipsing in and out of the nearby townhouse or being out on the road at a military installation and so on and so forth. And these Secret Service guys couldn't assure the security of the president during that time. You know, one of them might have stabbed the president.
Right. Yeah, that's a nice point.
You know, there were various kinds of disgruntlements in the Secret Service that would make some of them more inclined to go and not question a stand down, whereas others would, of course, be loyal and insistent on doing their job.
Many would be envious, but they'd also feel they were being abused because they were being treated, well, not quite as pimps, but as, you know, something different than how they thought they ought to be treated. I would just add that I find Robert Morrow a very determined, intelligent, and persevering scholar. It turns out I hadn't known before until we had a recent conversation that he's also a graduate of Princeton, so that he and I, you know, share that same institutional origin as our, you know, launching pad for our intellectual lives. But I've been very impressed, Morgan, with Robert Morrow's thoroughness as a scholar. Actually, he's quite good.
I agree. I had a conversation with him just yesterday. Yes. And he's a man after my own heart in that, hey, the truth, ugly, beautiful, or in between.
Yeah, warts and all.
And I would say, hey, there are various problems with the JFK research establishment when a Phil Nelson comes along. You know, some of them are protecting, call it, dogma that's being undermined by this new approach
Morgan,
and the facts around it.
It's been very embarrassing. You and I both know from the Deep Politics Forum that there are those there who won't even, you know, show the least open-mindedness to a mass of evidence about Lyndon's key role as the pivotal player. Morgan, we got to take our final break. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, with my special guest, Morgan Reynolds. We'll be right back.
Cell research, abortion, cloning, evolution, creation science, intelligent design. These are hot button issues today. Religion and science, morality and government, corporations and fascism. If you want to know what's happening to this nation this very day, then you won't want to miss Render Unto Darwin. After 35 years of teaching logic, critical thinking, and scientific reasoning, Jim Fetzer offers a critique of the Christian Rights Crusade against science. If you want to understand the issues, if you want to be informed, this is a book you won't want to miss. Render Unto Darwin, at Amazon.com and the major bookstores. Render Unto Darwin.
I give her all my love, that's all I do. And if you saw my love, you'd love her too. I love her. She gives me everything and tenderly. The kiss my lover brings, she brings to me, and I love her. A love like ours could never die, as long as I have you near me. Bright are the stars that shine, dark is the sky. I know this love of mine will never die. will chime. Dark is the sky. I know this love of mine will never die, and I love her.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, concluding my conversation with Morgan Reynolds, professor emeritus at Texas A&M, former director of the Criminal Justice Center at the National Center for Policy Analysis, which is based in Dallas, Texas, and the first prominent government official to publicly claim 9/11 was an inside job. Morgan, we find interesting things about researchers in different fields when we get involved in this stuff, whether it's JFK or 9/11. It's really quite astonishing in many ways.
It is. It's in a way, it was a little discouraging. I went on the Deep Politics Forum hoping for an intelligent discussion of the Nelson book on LBJ. And you find the same kind of character assassination and diversions and defense of what I consider indefensible propositions, you know, the failure to offer evidence on behalf or to ignore evidence offered. Or to just throw away, let's say, a Cy Hirsch book, The Dark Side of Camelot, because, you know, somehow St. Jack Kennedy is being impugned or somehow going to justify the assassination.
I mean,
who knows? We're trying to find the truth here, and lots of factors play into it. But in terms of the parallels, I had a couple points here to offer that, I think are interesting here between JFK and 9/11.
Good.
If you look at after the event, number one, there's pressure to appoint a national commission. Now, LBJ controlled that, you know, the prime suspect. And in the case of 9/11, Bush-Cheney were able to fend this off, or it didn't really culminate to a high level for a year and a half. But anyway, the parallels are obvious.
They put it off for 441 days. They wouldn't testify under oath. They insisted on going together so Cheney could hold Bush's hand so that he wouldn't...
More of the same, right,
yeah.
Exactly. Look at what LBJ did in terms of testimony. He put his signature on a brief statement. It's not under oath. It's not public testimony. There's no transcript. Here's the prime suspect in any assassination. You should look right away to who benefits.
Right.
He should be high on the list.
Right.
And then look at who LBJ appoints, you know, owned people. Alan Dulles.
Yeah.
John J. McCloy. Gerald Ford.
I know.
You know. And then later the commission, a majority of the commissioners disavow their own report.
Yes.
Although they shafted, in the case of the Warren Commission, they shafted Richard Russell and Hale Boggs because they were going to, they said, oh, fine, we'll have a minority report. But then it's released, and there's no minority report.
Oh, I know. There were three or four, I think, of them who were going to have some dissent to different aspects of it, and they were promised it would be there, but it was, in fact, of course, excluded.
And you know what the standard, a lot of people call for an investigation about 9/11, you know, some official investigation to give us a little more satisfaction, and it would be very little more. Because look at who are appointed, you know, in the, as jurors, or in, as commissioners. They are all mobbed up, you know, Thomas Kane and Hamilton.
Right. Yeah.
Come on, they have histories of being the handmaidens of the establishment and cover-up artists.
You know, it's remarkable.
Go down the list.
You know, it's remarkable there, Morgan, isn't that they were put in that position, but that they later said they themselves had been deceived. That's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
They complained. They said that, you know, the NORAD gave them three different stories about why there wasn't, an Air Force response that day. Three different stories.
And we was caught by surprise.
Caught by surprise.
Our entire national defense system, the Secret Service was caught by surprise.
All it takes is those 19 pure guys with box cutters. All it takes is one guy with a Mannlicher Carcano.
You know, tell me better lies.
Yeah.
And, you know, Phil Nelson at one point in his book on LBJ says, and I wish I could find it right away, but he says in effect that, you know, this is such a poorly covered up crime that they're just, demonstrating how gullible and stupid the public is.
Yes.
You know?
And
there is a little of that going on.
Well, you know, Morgan, that's been huge with regard to 9/11. I mean, the public's gullibility about 9/11 is stunning to me, absolutely stunning. I mean, have we been
They have the cover-up agency of last resort, the so-called independent corporate media.
Yes.
In other words, they'll clean it all up. They'll keep it bottled up. And that's kind of worked well so far. And, they even have, of course, a plan B, a backup story that's still going to be allow people to believe in the Muslim terrorist story.
Yeah.
You know, because if it's conventional explosives or nanothermite, that could be tagged, pinned on anybody. Remember Bush coming out in the Rose Garden and saying that KSM, after torture, waterboarding, et cetera, told us how they plant the explosives high up in the building so as to trap the most people possible. this only makes sense in a Bush brain.
The stupidity of this.
Right. So there's so many parallels, and when you go in like Nelson did with this, let's really test this thesis, and it works out surprisingly well.
Yeah.
I think that's why it's shaken up some in the JFK research community. So, another one of their themes is that these kind of unnamed or mysterious forces of history are the powerful forces of the elite or something.
Yes.
Only individuals act.
Only individuals think.
Only individuals conspire toward ignoble ends. So that's what the man in the street wants to know. Come on, who's responsible for this, right?
Right. Not to be told it's the military-industrial complex, for God's sake.
Yes. There's no harm in bringing that, but I think that's one of the things that the Phil Nelson book has fractured badly. Because we've got an acting individual, and nobody believes that LBJ would be in contact with a Lee Harvey Oswald or anything at that level.
Anything
to do with rigging patsies or how to arrange the shooting. He's not going to get into that kind of detail.
Of course not.
This is the chairman of the board type guy.
That's right.
The prime criminal.
That's right, but by God, he was a hands-on guy. He would make sure everything would come out right. He even sent Cliff Carter down to Dallas to make sure all the arrangements for the assassination were in place. And Malcolm Wallace, who was his personal hitman.
He called, the Captain Fritz or Henry Wade, the district attorney, and so on. So he would do hands-on where he thinks something needs more of the Johnson treatment.
That's right. He called Charles Crenshaw, who was looking after Lee Oswald, to tell him he wanted a deathbed confession. He called him personally. It's absolutely astounding. It's astounding.
Mind-boggling.
It is.
That anybody would say it's obvious that he didn't know it. Take also his ducking. He was one jumpy son of a bitch. We were told by a couple of the motorcycle cops. And, Senator Yarbrough, why is this guy? They had this, walking.
He was on the floor
way down.
I think he was on the floor before any shots were fired at all.
Yeah. Some 30 seconds before.
Yeah.
We're making the turn from Houston on to Elm, where the shooting's going to go down.
Yep.
He's on the floor. And, Phil Nelson has this wonderful story. He's a big man with a big penis, he'd be willing to show you. But He's a physical coward.
Yes, you know, yes,
yes. He's a big bully, a murderer, on and on. He's a
ruthless and manipulative, yes.
Yeah, he tells a story, and it's probably from Robert Carroll, and I bet it's easily confirmed, about he almost gets in a fight at a card game. Some guy, you know, they're just like, somebody's accused of cheating, and over, you know, some fisticuffs may ensue. You know, hey, LBJ goes over backward and starts, you know, pedaling his feet up in the air like a girl, as somebody said.
Isn't that too much?
It is. he's like any bully. Call her bluff, and he's a coward. A rotten coward.
You know, it's bizarre that there were two kinds of attitudes we encountered in discussing the Nelson book on the Deep Politics Forum. One was the clear exaggeration of the extent to which Lyndon would have had to manipulate every single detail in order to qualify as the mastermind. This is coming from Jim DiEugenio. And then there was the institutional, you know, holding the Deep Politics model, that it really, it's as though the persons or the individuals didn't matter, which, of course, was the view being represented by Charles Drago. I was fairly stunned because I wasn't convinced that either of them actually had read the book, to tell the truth. It bothered me tremendously.
Well, one of their counter-arguments was the assassination setup in Chicago.
Yeah. Or, Abraham Bolden,
In, was it Miami or Tampa?
Miami.
Well, here's one thought about that, and that is, okay, LBJ may or may not have been involved, and somebody else may have attempted an assassination. Those are separate cases. And, you know, if you're a prosecutor, I have a son who's a prosecutor, former prosecutor, and he's a criminal defense attorney. Well, when you're a prosecutor, in order to get a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt from a panel of 12 jurors, you have to prove every element in the charge.
Yes.
Well, Phil Nelson has only got to prove LBJ was the instigator or the prime perp in the JFK assassination that actually happened. He doesn't have, as a prosecutor, and here's where a high standard of evidence, et cetera. So I'm just saying, how many elements does he have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt? You've got your man right here,
and there's
LBJ.
And there's so many who knew him up close and personal, Morgan, who drew the same conclusion. Madeline Duncan Brown talks about Texas in the Morning. I had over 100 conversations with her. Billy Saul Estes, who performed all these scams and benefited Connally and Lyndon and all their buddies, became convinced. They both were convinced. Madeline even had, you know, a direct confrontation with Lyndon during a rendezvous on New Year's Eve at the Driscoll Hotel just 6 weeks after the assassination, confronting him with rumors rampant in Dallas at the time that he'd been involved, since no one stood to gain more personally. And he blew up at her and told her the CIA and the oil boys had decided that Jack had to be taken out. And then you get all this corroborating evidence, you know, that substantiates it further. You even got Jack Ruby saying that if someone else had been vice president, that this guy would not have been knocked off. Jack Ruby, who knew all this, what was going on up close and personal. And it's, you know, to me it's just stunning that anyone's going to want to evade this, especially when you start putting together all the key pieces where Lyndon was responsible. As you mentioned, calling Henry Wade or calling, you know, Will Fritz or contacting Charles Crenshaw, who told me personally about his conversation with Lyndon. I mean, it's astounding.
There's selectivity in evidence, okay? Evidence may be impeachable, but for the time being, until you show it, it is evidence. So, for example, they dismissed Jack Ruby. He's a mob guy. He murdered Lee Oswald. You know, Madeline's the mistress. You know, they have a reason. Billy Saul Essies is a con man. And
right, I know,
felon.
But this is all ridiculous. And, I mean, Lyndon wasn't consorting with nuns and saints, for God's sake. I mean,
and then what was kind of laughable to me is that DiEugenio, in particular, he goes on about how whatever Kenny O'Donnell or Dave Powers say is gospel because they were with Kennedy. Well, come on. they have an obvious interest in spinning this whole story to serve the Kennedy legacy.
Well,
they're,
you know,
Kennedy guys. So you want to play that game, we can play this game. But
well, you know, in Tip O'Neill's book, Man of the House, he revealed how he had these guys, I think it was Kenny, over to dinner, and Kenny was telling him there were bullets whizzing all over the place, and Tip said, well, that's not what you told the Warren Commission, and he sheepishly admitted, yeah, well, you know, he thought the Kennedy family wanted to get behind them, so he told them what they wanted to hear. But Lyndon was the one person who could guarantee that anyone who'd been involved in the assassination would not be pursued and prosecuted. That was his key role in making it all tie together. He was the pivotal player. He was the only one who could do that together, of course, in association with his close friend, J. Edgar.
Somebody pointed out, you know, the list of the usual suspects, kind of the mid-level of the operation would be, Alan Dulles. Well, you might put him higher, but you got Ed Lansdale and...
Yeah, David Sanchez Morales William Harvey.
Yeah, there's kind of a half a dozen.
David Attlee Phillips. Yeah.
Yes, David Attlee Phillips. but there's somebody was pointing out that Richard Helms is overlooked.
Yes.
And yet he was kind of the covert operations guy.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be Alan Dulles so directly.
Right.
He would sign off on this assassination attempt and that one and so on and so forth. But Richard Helms needs a little more work. And
you're
I
right.
picked up my, I have an encyclopedia of the Central Intelligence Agency, and I go, and this is, you might be familiar with these, you know, Checkmark, it's one of these commercial publishers, it's just conventional wisdom or safe encyclopedia stuff. So I open it up to Richard Helms, and they have a really nice half-page black and white photograph. Richard Helms meeting with President Lyndon B. Johnson.
Yes.
I said, how ironic.
That's
what are they
nice.
Giving away here?
That's nice.
Yeah.
I like that. And yeah.
So, you know, and this business about, Alan Dulles, he was canned, but it was months later by JFK. Well, he still got it. He was Mr. CIA, you know.
Of course.
I mean, his strings into that bunch to do an illicit.
Then they want to so casually dismiss what E. Howard Hunt has to say. I mean, here's a guy on his deathbed who's admitting he was involved in it, that he was on the back bench, but he's given an enumeration to his son, St. John, about who was involved, and he talks about Lyndon and Cord Meyer and David Sanchez Morales and David Attlee Phillips and William Harvey. I mean, he's going down the list, and these are exactly the persons you'd expect to be involved indeed if this was what we think it was, what we know it was.
Okay, now here's an issue on which we don't agree, and we can do it civilly, which is great. E. Howard Hunt, of course, I believe that E. Howard Hunt is one of the three tramps there at Dealey Plaza.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And this goes to the issue, we agree, E. Howard Hunt is in on it, as his deathbed confession admits. And we shouldn't throw it out as being more deception from the deathbed. And by the way, hey, I'm going to go on another distraction or cul-de-sac, and that is my wife was in a hospice team manager in Northern Virginia, and they had one hospice patient that I had not been able to identify who was high up in the CIA and knew a lot, and of course is dying. They had a man in a suit with a gun there, 724.
Really?
So that there wouldn't be anything important given up to the hospice personnel or whoever happened to be there.
Somebody coming in with a tape recorder,
So they're well aware that an E. Howard Hunt might be giving something up.
Yeah.
But this question of facial recognition came up on another Deep Politics forum, and we don't agree on that, because Lucian Conine has been identified as the man in the one picture that
right above JFK's head, right above his head, turning from Houston on down.
And Alan Eaglesham, of course, corrected himself on new information volunteered. What was that? 2 years ago, I believe.
Yeah.
And say, oh, well, I made a mistake. This is really Robert Adams, I believe.
Yeah.
Well, I do, too, partly because of, again, you know, these facial recognition things are close calls, and quite often measurements won't turn the trick. And we know that Jack White, the famous photo analyst, came up inconclusive. And I called Frank Caplet, the man who volunteered this information, that he happened to be in this house in Dallas, and they stumbled across this. And I just want to point out that he is going to send me more information, but this guy was very genuine, and his... this was pure serendipity.
Well,
because he goes way back at being a bit of a buff about the JFK, and he recognized this picture, and he said, who is this? And it turns out this was at the aunt of his companion.
Yeah.
Okay. And so anyway, the point is that the reasonable people can disagree sometimes.
Oh, I'm quite sure it's Conan, and that they needed a way to excuse his presence there because it was so telling. I mean, the plaque that was used to support this case was ridiculous fabrication.
It wasn't a plaque. That was a misstatement by Frank
Morgan,
Caplet.
Morgan, I haven't resisted. You're saying your piece. Let me just get mine in edgewise.
Okay.
It's a fabricated newspaper article put together with a real newspaper article that attributes, it's supposed to be recognizing him for being caught in a photograph, which is ridiculous on its face. But it has the wrong date. It says it was on the 25th of November and the wrong day of the week, Thursday. I mean, this is just ridiculous. So that, you know, the whole thing appears to me to be contrived. But let me just say, Morgan, listen, I agree with you. We look at this stuff. Jack did actually a very good job. He came up with a half a dozen features that distinguish the two of them. His considered opinion is it's about 95% that it's Conan and only 5% that it's Adams, and I'm willing to rest with that.
Well, his latest, he reduced the odds, although he still tipped in favor of the Conan, so I just need to work on him a little bit more.
Well, Morgan, it's such a pleasure having you here. And by the way, Jesse was very skillful about using that. He just said in relation to the third tramp that many students of JFK believe that this was E. Howard Hutt to make the transition to his son, St. John, and that was, of course, accurate because there are many who do, including you and Jack White, too. So, I want to thank you for coming on, Morgan. I look forward to getting you back again. It's been too long, and it's just such a pleasure. We covered a lot.
I enjoyed it. Jim, thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, my great pleasure, Morgan. We covered a lot of subjects today. This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, thanking my special guest, Morgan Reynolds, for being here and all of you for listening.
Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, I'm not half the man I used to be. There's a shadow hanging over me. Oh, yesterday, and suddenly, why she had to go, I don't know. She say, I said something wrong, now I long for yesterday, love was such an easy